When the song of angels is stilled, when the star is gone from the sky, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among brothers, to make music in the heart. That is the real work of Christmas. Good morning, all you hardy souls who have made it out despite the orange weather warning. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. Thank you for being here. My name is Pamela McCarthy. I'm a member of the congregation here. We have a tradition here that members of the congregation lead the service from time to time. This is not a particularly exclusive club. If you feel that there's something you'd like to share with us, if you have an idea, a thought, a book you want to share, you could talk to our chairperson, Denise, and she'll talk to you about doing a service. Also, you don't have to do it on your own. You will get help and support if you ask for it. You do not have to agree with anything I say today. These ideas are largely my own. If you feel particularly strongly that I have said something that you disagree with violently, please talk to Denise and she'll give you the opportunity. You can tell us all from the pulpit where I have gone wrong and what you dislike about what I have said. And I'll even come and listen to you. We gather this hour as people of faith, with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together. We now have our first hymn, hymn number 271, Come Down, O Love Divine. Our reader this morning is Tony.
Good morning. Here I am. Thank you, Merlin. Standing upright. Happy New Year to this seems to be working. Is it working? Happy New Year to all of you, and thanks very much to Pamela for taking the service. Very glad to see her face. Normally, I read from W.B. Yeats, as you know. Today, however, I'm not. I'm going to read the last page of James Joyce's The Dead, which is the greatest short story that was ever written. It's the last story in Dumnus. He actually added it a year later, which is interesting. And it's about the snow. In fact, it may even be a weather forecast for Ireland, because Gabriel had read that morning in the paper, I think he read the Irish Times, that snow was general over Ireland. But we're not quite there yet. Anyway, I'll read this. The air of the room chilled his shoulders. He stretched himself cautiously along under the sheets and lay down beside his wife. One by one, they were all becoming shades. Better pass boldly into that other world, in the full glory of some passion, than fade and wither dismally with age. He thought of how she who lay beside him had locked in her heart for so many years that image of her lover's eyes, when he had told her that he did not wish to live. Generous tears filled Gabriel's eyes. He had never felt like that himself towards any woman, but he knew that such a feeling must be love. The tears gathered more thickly in his eyes, and in the partial darkness, he imagined he saw the form of a young man standing under a dripping tree. Other forms were near. His soul had approached that region
where dwell the vast hosts of the dead. He was conscious of, but could not apprehend, their wayward and flickering existence. His own identity was fading out into a gray and palpable world. The solid world itself, which those these dead at one time reared and lived in, was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the window pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and further westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end upon all the living and all the dead.
Even though there are no children in the church today, I'm assuming that all of you are young at heart and that you listen to this not very important story. One of the joys of the Christmas holidays is all the adventure films that they show on television over Christmas. I love the Die Hard films. I enjoy watching the old James Bond films, even though they have become totally politically incorrect, like they just don't work to the same way in the modern world. But my favorite adventure hero has to be Indiana Jones. So this story comes from a scene in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. In Indiana and his two companions have a series of madcap adventures seeking Indiana's father and the Holy Grail. But did you notice that in adventure stories, as sometimes happens in life, people have to make important decisions under pressure? Without time or without enough time or information, the hero, and sometimes you, have to make a choice, the results of which can linger for a long time. Eventually, after a whole lot of adventures and really mad scenes, like he's chased in a zeppelin by Spitfires, and it's totally unbelievable, but this is the magic of it. Indy and his two friends enter the cave where the Holy Grail is. Now, this is a real bummer for these people, because you would expect that having risked life and limb and adventured across continents to find the Holy Grail, when you come to the cave where the Grail is, you'd expect that it would be sitting there on a table with a sign around it or something. Here it is. Success, you've done it. Instead of that, Indiana and his companions, Walter and Elsa, find themselves confronted by positively a sea of grails. And at this stage, Indiana has worked out that his two companions, Walter and Elsa, are not actually his friends. They've been using him to get their hands on the grail. And they have to make a choice. Which one of these cups is actually the grail? And Elsa, unfortunately, shows her true colors. She picks up a very ornate, expensive looking cup and hands it to Walter and suggests, there you are. But of course, it's not the right, it's not the grail at all, at all, at all. And when he drinks out of it, he suffers a dreadful fate. But Elsa has achieved her ambition. The competition for the grail has diminished from three people to two. Now all she needs to do is watch Indy pick the right one and then grab it off him afterwards. This is an exercise in decision making, and all of us have to make decisions, and this will be relevant for my address afterwards. Of course, Indiana Jones is a professor of archaeology. He has no bother at all picking out the right grail. He saves his father's life, and then the story carries on. There are a whole lot of other adventures, and the good folk live happily ever after, and none of the bad guys ever return home. Would that life were so simple. The Joy of Christmas Movies. We will now have our second hymn, 281. O God, our help in ages past, hymn number 281. Let us pray. Please now turn to reading number 519 in the back of your hymnal. I'll read the lines in ordinary type, and if you would read the ones in italics. This is 519. Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain. Let me not look for allies in life's battlefield. Let me not crave in anxious fear to be saved. Grant me that I may not be a coward, feeling your mercy only in my success. For my reading this morning, I have chosen an extract from the book, The Code of the Extraordinary Mind, written by Vishen Lakhiani. He's the founder of Mind Valley. It's one of these self-improvement sites. He organizes conferences, and he can recommend whatever sort of self-improvement you feel you need. And even ones you've never heard of or that you might never have imagined. He's a very interesting character because he's not a European, he's from Malaysia, but he teaches meditation and spiritual practices in the Western world. The piece I have chosen to read is called The Lies We Choose to Believe. Human beings simultaneously exist in two worlds. There is the physical world of absolute truth and the culturescape of relative truth. In the culturescape, all the ideas we hold dear, our identity, our religion, our nationality, our beliefs about the world, are nothing more than mental constructs we've chosen to believe. And like all mental constructs, many are merely opinions we believe because they were drilled into us as children and accepted by the culture we grew up in. Human beings are far less rational than we think. Many ideas we hold dear and cling to as truth fall apart under closer inspection. Our mental constructs of the world can change, pivot, expand, and shrink as human cultures, ideologies, and opinions collide, dance, and clash with each other. Just as disease is spread by contagion from host to victim, so ideas are spread in the same way. We often take on ideas not through rational thought, but through social contagion. The act of an idea spreading from mind to mind, without any due questioning. Thus, our so-called truths are rarely optimal ways of life. As consumer psychologist Paul Marston, PhD, wrote in a paper called Mimetics and Social Contagion, Two Sides of the Same Coin, whilst we may like to believe that we are consciously and rationally decide on how to respond to situations, Social contagion evidence suggests that some of the time this is simply not the case. Rather than generating and having beliefs, emotions, and behavior, social contagion research suggests that, in some very real sense, those beliefs, emotions, and behaviors have us. When we are unsure how to react to a stimulus or a situation, these theories suggest that we actively look to others for guidance and consciously imitate them. It's a stunning statement. Dr. Marston is saying that when we make decisions, we're more likely to defer to the hive mind than to make a decision based entirely on our own best interests. We don't have beliefs so much as beliefs have us. This is perhaps one of the most important lines in Dr. Marston's paper. We think we're making a rational decision, but often the decision has little to do with rationality and more to do with ideas our family, culture, and peers have approved. There's nothing wrong with taking on ideas from the society we live in, but as our world is undergoing exponential change at a staggering pace, following the masses and doing what has always been done isn't a path that leads to being extraordinary. Ideas, memes, and culture are meant to evolve and change, and we are best served when we question them. Words from Vishen Lakhiani. Let us pray. To help us settle into a meditative or prayerful state, I'll read The Blessing for Light by John O'Donohue, and then we'll have a period of silence. For light. Light cannot see inside things. That is what dark is for. Minding the interior, nurturing the draw of growth through places where death, in its own way, turns into life. In the glare of neon times, let our eyes not be worn by surfaces that shine with hunger made attractive. That our thoughts may be true light, finding their way into words which have the weight of shadow to hold the weight of truth. That we never place our trust in minds claimed by empty light, where one-sided certainties are driven by false desire. When we look into the heart, may our eyes have the kindness and reverence of candlelight. That the search of our minds be equal to the oblique crevices where the mystery continues to dwell, glimmering in fugitive light. When we are confined inside the dark house of suffering, that moonlight might find a shadow. When we become so false and lost that the severe noon light would cast our shadow clear. When we love, that dawn light would lighten our feet upon the waters. As we grow old, the twilight would illuminate treasures in the fields of memory. And when we come to search for God, let us first be robed in night, put on the minds of morning to feel the rush of light spread slowly inside the color and stillness of a found world. Amen.
Thank you.
Now that we have survived the dramas of Christmas and the fireworks of the new year, but have not yet settled down into the groove of our ordinary day-to-day life, now is a good time to have a look at the rules and beliefs that govern our day-to-day lives. Have a look at the things that you live by. What are your rules? What are your beliefs? Are they all rational? Probably not, but that doesn't matter. Rationality is not essential, but are they useful? Are the things you believe in helping your life, nourishing your life, building community, or are they just causing trouble? This endeavour is very important, I think, because Christian congregations, and also congregations like this one that have their roots in Christianity, are fading and failing. Because the beliefs and the wisdom that they propose are increasingly irrelevant and no longer reach the souls of seekers after the divine. When I'm feeling particularly grouchy and at war with the world, I divide the Christian wisdom and the Christian tenets into two untidy heaps. On the one hand, there's all the stuff that I never do anyway, so there's no point in telling me to do it or not to do it. It's irrelevant. And on the other hand, there's all the stuff that I will do anyway, and no amount of encouragement or discouragement seems to affect it. In the heap of stuff that I don't go near are things like the rule, keep holy the Sabbath. I mean, what does that actually mean? About 10 years ago, when I was engaging with this idea and thinking that maybe a Sabbath is a good idea, I arbitrarily nominated Wednesday as the Sabbath because that's a day that works for me. I mean, the Old Testament says that the Sabbath is the seventh day of the week, which if you count Sunday as day one, it's Saturday. There are so many days that you could pick. So if you're going to nominate a Sabbath, why not pick one that works with your lifestyle? Now, as I say, that's all in the heap, that's all in the bin side of the equation. In the bin side of the equation, too, are the rules about coveting. I don't covet. I mean, I don't want my neighbour's wife. And I'll talk to the neighbours and my neighbours' wives and are friendly people, and if I want any advice or help or encouragement from them, I just have to ask. I don't have to actually steal the woman and bring her home. It's the same thing with coveting donkeys. I mean, I live in the city. None of my neighbors have donkeys. So the question just does not arise. There are umpteen other examples of this kind of thing, but I think you get the picture. On the other side of the equation are the things that are frowned upon, but I do anyway. Into that bracket, I would put the things like do not lie. I mean, come on, seriously? We are all a bit, we all bend the truth from time to time, and we make allowances and accommodations, and the fact that somebody, God or his representative, said don't lie, I'm sorry, it just really doesn't affect me that much. Into that same bracket, too, comes more seriously the one, do not kill. Now, clearly, I'm not a murderer. I wouldn't be here if that was the case, not directly. But here in the Western world, we kill in a much more insidious way. Every time you turn on the television and see pictures of destroyed buildings and wrecked hospitals, the ordinance that destroyed that came from the Western world. Arms dealing is our dirty little secret, and we are all of us complicit in this, even though I can put my hands up and say I didn't kill anyone. But the blood is nonetheless on my hands because I live in a society that supports the arms industry. And if that wasn't bad enough, the European Union is one of the biggest producers of toxic agricultural chemicals. So what we don't kill with our bullets, we're spraying to death. So killing is something that I have a responsibility for. I'm not sure how I can avoid this, but or how I can get away from it, wipe the slate clean, but killing is part of what I do. Now, let's turn to Judge Not. This is the one that got up my nose some time ago, because I have a friend who said to me, he hopes the next generation will grow up compassionate and non-judgmental. And I thought, hold on a minute now. Judgment is a very important part of what we do. If we rear a generation of kids who can't judge, can't make decisions, can't pick, can't even decide what's right and wrong, they won't be fit to leave the house. In fact, they won't be fit to stay in the house either. They'll have to have somebody looking after them 24 hours a day. So I thought, this is one of the sayings of Jesus. Clearly I have missed something here. I'll have to investigate this a bit farther. So I got out my Bible, my wonderful interlinear Greek and English New Testament. Judge not, let ye be judged, comes from the first verse of chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel. So I thought, I wonder, what does it say in Greek? Now, I don't know a lot of ancient Greek, but I decided anyway, let's just go and have a look. Like, clearly, when judge not is a silly idea to me, but this is handed down tradition. I must have missed something, so let's have a look. Now, let me see. Oh, yeah. What judge not, according to the Greek, comes from me crinite. Crinite is a standard imperative. It's an instruction. The me bit is, negates it. So this judge not is a really good translation to that. But then I thought, this Greek verb, maybe it has been badly translated. So then I spent a very happy hour searching for the Greek, ancient Greek English dictionary. There is definitely one in my house, but after an hour of searching, I couldn't find it. So I was still puzzled about this. So I searched around again, and I came across a Teach Yourself Ancient Greek. This was an idea that I had years ago. I haven't read beyond the first chapter, but maybe. I can't put the book in the bin either, because maybe in some time I will actually start learning ancient Greek. But at the back of this book, there's a glossary. They give the words. So, krino was given. So I said, great, what does it actually mean? According to the glossary in the back of Teach Yourself Ancient Greek, the word krino means to judge, to decide, to select, or to choose. That's even worse. If you say to somebody, don't judge, you can make some excuse for saying to somebody, don't judge. But if you say, don't choose, don't decide, don't select, how are you going to survive in the world if you don't do that? My suspicion with this, judge not, lest ye be judged, is that this was put in because the powers that be wanted people like you and me to listen to them, not to make up our minds ourselves. This was, I think the idea behind this was that it blocks us from making choices about things. We should listen to our betters, people who are better educated, who really know ancient Greek. They'll be able to tell us what we need to know. And that's not an idea that's going to wash in the world today. Now, there are problems in the world today, and there are situations where judge not is a useful approach, especially when it comes to social media. There are a lot of very abusive posts out there, and a lot of people are damaged by what's posted on social media. But the people who make these posts, I don't think they're going to be touched or impressed if I say, oi, don't judge. That's not the solution. Enough about judge not. I think you could take the same broom to that tenet of Christianity. You know, the one where Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. That is a good idea, but I don't think it's good. It's it's enough for the world we live in. I mean, I would argue that God today doesn't need to be loved. We would make a far better impression on the world if we respected creation. Don't kill the spider. Don't stamp on the ant. Appreciate the things that God has given us. And don't destroy people or things that we consider to be inconvenient or just don't like. And then as for loving our neighbour, I don't think our neighbour needs to be loved. I mean, we're living in the city, for heaven's sake. Our neighbour should be treated with respect and should be left to get on with his life in peace. When I hear this, love your neighbour as yourself, I think of my neighbour. I have a neighbour. He's a mad individual, but he's a whole lot of fun. But the reason I know him is because he has a dog. And my dog and his dog don't like one another, but we get on fine, the owners of the dog. And he was telling me he's not getting on with his neighbour. And I said, oh dear, what's wrong? He said, well, he said, I play my electric guitar at night and he doesn't like it. So I think you could stop playing your electric guitar at night rather than loving the neighbour. This would make far more, would bring far more peace and harmony into the world. And the neighbour, though, does not sit there quietly while this noise is made. He has acquired a silent dog whistle. So we have two houses side by side. One plays the electric guitar at night and the other drives the dog nuts. I think you could treat your neighbor well without actually loving him. Just have a little bit of concern. We don't need to go as far as love. So now that I have taken a broom to some of the great wisdom of the Christian tradition, I can't very well leave you here with nothing. Where do we go for wisdom that will help us today? Something that we can use to guide our lives, to help us so that we're not loving our neighbor or we're not loving God, but we show respect to creation and we live in some state, I don't like to say armed truce, but so that we can live in some kind of accommodation with our neighbors. I think we have a lot to learn from Jordan Peterson. Aidan last week introduced us to the Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. He's not necessarily the only guide out there. I mean, there are more thinkers out there, but Jordan Peterson has a lot to say that touches the spot. One of the problems, I think, with the sort of passive way religion has gone is that we sit at home and we are bombarded by negative messages on television. And we have our neighbor playing the electric guitar in the middle of the night and life is miserable and we have an orange-yellow warning so we can't go out. And life becomes very unpleasant and we sit there imagining that there's nothing we can do, that we just have to sit in misery and that we have no agency ourselves. This is where Jordan Peterson comes in. He looks at the world and he says things like, when I was ironing one day recently, he was saying, don't lie. And then he looked I felt he was looking at me out of the screen and my monitor, and he said, but somebody as stupid as you, how do you know whether something is true or not? Just stop saying things you know to be not true. The same way in his 12 Rules for Life, he says, Rule 6, set your house in perfect order before criticizing the world. This gives you a task, so you can't complain about the world until you have made an effort to make even one corner of it satisfactory. Then he says, Rule 7, pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Again, a useful guide to living our lives. Now, Jordan Peterson is not a romantic. He's a conservative, but he's clear-sighted. He accepts that the world is a tough place. He has written, life is very hard. Everyone is destined for pain and slated for destruction. But at the same time, life is a wonderful gift. We need to use our lives. We need to not sit at home depressed and miserable. Just because the old answers don't work anymore doesn't mean we quite put them in the bin. We put them on the shelf of the hard things. We put it up there beside the teach yourself ancient Greek and teach yourself everything else that someday you will get to, and someday maybe we'll get back to them. But in the meantime, we have to live our lives with as much hope, with as much vigor, with as much enthusiasm as we can manage. I am going to close with a piece written by Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day was a wonderful woman. She set up the Catholic worker movement, and the whole Catholic Church, the powers that be, don't know what to make of her because she was a misfit. She did wonderful work, but she's clearly never going to be a saint. Her private life was too far from sainthood, shall we say. But the words of Dorothy Day: people say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do. Amen. Despite all I've said about rules, I'm slightly bending the rules here because I like the hymn 238, Deck the Hall with Boughs of Holly, and it's not quite the Christmas period, but please sing it with verve. I'd like to thank all of you who have come here for the service today. Thank you for being here. Special thanks to Tony Roach for his wonderful reading, and to Merlin, who has facilitated it. To our welcomers, Paula Mills upstairs and Janet Mulroy downstairs. To Paula for the flowers as well. There's tea and coffee served downstairs after the service. Please come down. Alison, Paul, and Maeve are providing the service, so please don't expect them to drink all the coffee on their own. The book club are carrying over Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner for this month's meeting on the last Wednesday of the month, and also reading Butter by Asako Yazuki. Wednesday services start again this Wednesday, and next Sunday Paul Murray is leading the service. There will be a meeting of the Synod of Munster next Saturday at 11 a.m. via Zoom. The purpose of the meeting is to appoint trustees for the Cork Church. We now have our final hymn. This is one of the rules in this church that I can only pick Go Tell It on the Mountain in the first week in January or sometime in December. So it will be nearly a year before we can have Go Tell It on the Mountain again, and I love this hymn, so please, go tell it on the mountain loudly. May we leave our time together with spirits uplifted and hearts enlivened, renewed in our quest for peace and justice, ready to face whatever comes our way, and trust in the steadfast love of the Eternal. Amen.